This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
What do you do when something like those tornadoes happen? For some, it's just about anything that makes you feel normal. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Wake up to the day's top business headlines. Subscribe to the Marketplace Morning Report podcast. It's on iTunes and marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace Podcast for Tuesday, the 21st of May. Good to have you with us. The tornado yesterday in Moore, Oklahoma, was 1.3 miles wide, the National Weather Service said this afternoon. It's officially been classified as EF5. That is the strongest of possible tornadoes. Winds above 200 miles an hour. Hundreds of rescue crews and emergency teams are there working through the wreckage. For others in town, though, the best thing that they could do is go to work. We got Lori Ogie on the line from Moore. Lori, it's good to speak with you.
Yes, sir.
Tell me where we tracked you down, would you?
I work at Lock Supply in Moore, Oklahoma.
What kind of supply do you do, Lori?
Plumbing, heat and air, and electrical.
What do you know about whether your facility is still standing?
I'm in my facility now. I came back to work this morning.
They let you in?
Yeah, there's no power, there's no water, there's no power, but we have generators, and we've had no customers today, but with as a company, this is what we do.
Well, I'm kind of surprised you haven't had any customers, because while people are cleaning up, there will be demand for your supplies, right?
Not till they start rebuilding. Right now, they're deconstructing, not constructing.
Yeah, I guess.
Digging people out, basically, and the highway is going about 5 miles an hour, and they've got the military, they've got just helicopters, crews, emergency vehicles, just everything going on.
What are the managers at Walk Supply say? What are they telling you to do? Just hang around?
Well, yeah. We just come to work. It's better than me sitting home watching TV all day. I mean,
well,
you know.
I'll tell you what. That's what the rest of us have been doing on the outside, watching you guys on TV.
Yeah. But it's really, really, really sad. It's probably about when I came to work this morning, I could hardly see through the tears, number one. But you drive for a whole mile down the highway, and when you look to the left or the right, as far as you can see, is absolutely flattened, completely flattened. And all those poor people.
Were you in Moore in 1999, the last time these tornadoes came through?
No.
Yeah.
No, I lived in California. I'm from California. But I've lived here for 7 years, and this is the third time since I've lived here that a tornado has come as close as a quarter mile from me. And it's scary. It's really scary. It's a beautiful, beautiful state. It's the best people. I love it. But those tornadoes are scary, and it just looks like a war zone. It's the worst thing I've ever seen in my life. It's really, really, really bad.
What are you going to do the rest of the day, Lori?
I'm going to stay at work till 5 o'clock, probably in this dark building, see if we have a couple customers coming in. We just write hand tickets, and then I'm going to try to find a route going home.
Well, listen, good luck to you. Lori Ogie, she works at Lock Supply Company in Moore, Oklahoma. Lori, thanks a lot.
Thank you so much.
People in the path of that tornado yesterday had about 16 minutes to find shelter, thanks to an early warning system that's been in town. There's a lot of money going into improving that lead time to predicting tornadoes long before they touch down. Shannon Mullen has that story.
Scientists have been trying to figure out how to forecast tornadoes in the U.S. since the late 1800s.
You might think that by now we would actually understand how tornadoes form and why tornadoes form, but that's still a very open area of research.
Glenn Romine studies tornadoes at the federally funded National Center for Atmospheric Research.
We're still actively trying to go out and look at what's going on in those storms that do and don't produce a tornado and try to figure out what's different about them.
Romine's working with researchers who are flying over the Great Plains this spring. They're sampling the atmosphere where storms might form. Their goal? Better forecasts up to a day in advance. Other researchers are trying to give people more lead time to get out of a tornado's path. They know where to start, building thousands more Doppler radar stations. Scientist David McLaughlin says right now, existing stations are too far apart. Forecasters can't get information fast enough.
You can't really tell which streets and individual neighborhoods those vortices are going down unless it happens to be a well-behaved, mile-wide storm that everybody can see.
McLaughlin's director of the Collaborative Adapting Sensing of the Atmosphere. The group's developing a new network of shorter-range radars that would give more accurate and specific information.
There is this need for higher resolution, better observations close to the ground. Now, the question is, who has a couple billion dollars to actually deploy this across the entire country?
A grant from the National Science Foundation paid for testing of the system in Oklahoma. Now the prototype is set up in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, where cities are helping to pay for it. I'm Shannon Mullen for Marketplace.
After an early morning swoon, Wall Street did all right today. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Mr. Cook went to Washington today. Apple CEO Tim Cook spent some time in the company of the Senate Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations talking taxes, specifically how much Apple is paying on the $100 billion or so in cash that's held by its overseas subsidiaries. Cook was the unlucky CEO taking a turn in the barrel today, but the topic du jour was really all American companies that keep profits abroad to lower their tax bills. We asked Marketplace's Mark Garrison to go out and figure out what difference that money might make. Anyway.
First, let's get a sense of how much corporate money's overseas. Ed Kleinbard is the former chief of staff of Congress's Joint Committee on Taxation and now a USC law professor.
The scale is gigantic. That number is about $2 trillion right now.
Tax that at the top corporate rate, and America has an extra $700 billion. That's as big as the 2008 financial crisis bailout. In reality, hardly any companies actually pay the full 35%. You know, loopholes. But the tax revenues could still be hundreds of billions, which would be some shopping spree.
It's a lot of money.
David K. Johnston is a Syracuse law professor and columnist for Tax Analysts, who's made a career of investigating gaming the tax system.
It would have a tremendous impact on improving the federal budget, reducing the deficit, and of course, it's money we could be investing in our future.
Take your pick. Spend it on education, health, military, or use corporate tax revenue to cut taxes for actual humans. Most Americans would choose to help people over companies, but it's a little more complicated. Cook testified Apple pays everything it legally owes. In today's hearing, Republican Senator Rand Paul said companies are being wrongly vilified. Then he started talking about the man in the mirror.
Is there a Mr. Apple out there? No, it's us. You know, if you have a mutual fund, you probably own some Apple shares. If you're a teacher with a pension fund, you own Apple shares. If you're a fireman with a pension fund, you probably own Apple.
Boost a company's tax bill and the hit to the stock price can hurt your retirement savings. Changing any tax law squeezes somebody. That's why Apple and other companies have such big lobbying bills. In New York, I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
Michigan Senator Carl Levin presided at the Apple hearing this morning. Senator, it's good to have you with us.
Thank you. Great to be with you.
What were you hoping to get out of the hearing today, sir?
To shine a light on the tax code, how it functions with real people, real businesses. And what we learned is that the real world situation is just totally unacceptable.
Yeah, but Senator, everything Tim Cook does is legal, right? He said it today himself. Let me play this very quick piece of tape.
We pay all the taxes we owe. Every single dollar. We not only comply with the laws, but we comply with the spirit of the laws.
I wonder, Senator, whether the gripe you have isn't with Congress and the tax code that you guys wrote.
Well, it's with the tax code, the way it's written and the way it's implemented by the IRS, but it's also with the way in which companies are able to avoid paying taxes. It's true that they pay every dollar that they owe, and what they do is they shift the crown jewels of their company offshore to make sure that they don't pay a whole lot of taxes. They shift them to a tax haven. And so as a result of that shift of the intellectual property, they don't owe the taxes, but they avoid paying more taxes than they pay.
With all respect, Senator, you saying that we need to shine light on this and Congress has to change the tax code is a little bit like that scene in Casablanca where the guy goes, "I'm shocked to find gambling going on here." If you, who's been in the Senate since, well, a long time anyway, can't get anything done, what are the prospects for tax reform?
I think they're a lot better if people understand how taxes are avoided. Apple avoided paying more taxes than they paid. How do they do that? How do they do that? And the public has got to understand the technicalities of how they do it. We got 30 of our largest corporations in the world that earn $160 billion in profits that pay no taxes. And unless the public is upset about that, understands how companies are able to avoid paying taxes, then Congress is not going to be put under the kind of pressure which Congress needs to be put under in order to reform this system.
I'm going to try this one more time, Senator. It sure seems like you're saying Congress has to fix something without acknowledging that you're in Congress and you've been there for a long time, and yet the tax code is what it is.
That's absolutely true. I also voted against this gimmick. I mean, this isn't an issue about me, but I'm happy to defend my record if you want to shift the conversation to that. But the conversation today is about how some of the most profitable companies in the world are able to shift profits to tax havens.
Do you think you've got the American people's attention now by having Apple up there, one of the most profitable and popular companies in the country?
Well, I hope so. We also had the Microsoft up here. We showed how Microsoft shifted taxes away from themselves. Hewlett-Packard did it by these short-term loans, and I won't go into the details, but you have to shine the light on what they did. So what Apple said today is, well, we didn't do it the way Hewlett-Packard did it. We didn't do it the way Microsoft did it, and then they told us how they did it.
You've said you're not going to seek re-election next year, Senator, so spitball it for me. Does tax reform get done before you leave Washington?
Comprehensive tax reform? I don't know, but I'll tell you this.
What about nibbling around the edges?
What you call nibbling around the edges, I call getting rid of these totally unacceptable and unjustified tax loopholes. We can get rid of those, and whether or not we do comprehensive tax reform or not, I can't predict. I hope we do. But in any event, there are certain kind of unjustifiable loopholes which should be closed, and that revenue ought to go to deficit reduction or protecting our kids or protecting our health or protecting our skies. There's a lot of things we need to do that we cut back on.
Carl Levin, Democrat of Michigan. He chairs the Senate's Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations. Senator, thanks for your time, sir.
Sure. Good being with you.
This news today from the Marketplace desk of the more things change, the more they stay the same. Shareholders of J.P. Morgan Chase have voted to let Jamie Dimon keep both of his jobs. That would be CEO and chairman of the board. Wasn't even close. Just 32% of them voted to split the jobs. That was perhaps because Dimon hinted he'd quit if things didn't go his way, or also, perhaps, as Ben White wrote in Politico today, it was because Jamie Dimon did the one thing he had to do to guarantee the outcome of today's vote. That is, he made giant piles of money. Coming up, stop complaining about your cubicles, people.
There is a hidden cost in productivity and morale.
But first, let's do the numbers. A couple of Fed governors say the central bank is in no hurry to stop its bond buying program, and boom, 52 points on the blue chips. The Dow Industrials up a 3rd percent today, 15,387. The NASDAQ grew 5 points, that's about a 10%. 3502, the number you're looking for there. The S&P 500 tacked on 2 points, also a 10th percent as it happens. ended at 1669. Jamie Dimon keeps both his jobs, as we said. Chase shares up 1.5%. Goldman Sachs added 1% today. Morgan Stanley increased 0.2%. Apple paired off 0.7% today as Congress shined a light on its tax avoidance strategy. Yahoo bumped up another 1.5%. Home Depot hammered out a 2.5% gain today thanks to the housing market recovery. Home Improvement's number two, Lowe's, ticked up 0.2% in advance of tomorrow's earnings report. Bond prices, why they rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 1.93%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Show Marketplace how much you like us. Stay connected to our hosts, reporters, and top stories on Facebook. Find us at facebook.com/APM Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. It's an earnings day for retailers Target and American Eagle. We'll get a chance to look back at April when the National Association of Realtors releases existing home sales for the month. And on this day back in 1859, Sir Arthur Conan Doyle was born. He would go on to create the beloved detective Sherlock Holmes. And of course, My Dear Watson. I'm Bridget Bodner.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. There is going to be in London over the next couple of weeks something of a food revolution. A new kind of burger is going to be unveiled and then eaten, of course. The revolution part is that the beef in that burger was grown in a lab. And we're not talking soy here, people. It's the real deal. The research team behind it says the technology will not only satisfy the rapidly growing appetite we all have for meat around the world, it will also help save the planet. From the Marketplace European Desk, here's Stephen Beard.
Keeping pigs and rearing cattle are not clever ways of producing food, says Dutch scientist Mark Post. Making meat by the traditional method doesn't cut it anymore.
Cows and pigs are very inefficient animals. For every 15 grams of meat, you need to feed them with 100 grams of vegetable proteins. So it's a very, very low efficiency rate.
And that matters when global meat consumption is expected to double within the next 40 years.
With the current meat production method, that's practically impossible.
But he reckons he's found a way out of the impasse. In his laboratory at Maastricht University, Dr. Post has created what's thought to be the world's first test tube burger. 5 ounces of pink material grown in an incubator from cells taken from a cow's neck.
It's exactly the same as meat. Coming from the same cells, they have produced the same proteins. It tastes like meat. The only difference is that it's not grown within the animal, but outside.
He says this technology could hugely reduce the amount of land, energy and water required by traditional livestock farming, not to mention the problem of animal flatulence contributing to global warming. And it could also take the wind out of the sails of these people.
Animal murderers!
Animal murderers!
Animal welfare protesters might have less to shout about since there would be fewer living animals being reared for slaughter. But as the Maastricht experimenters acknowledge, these are still early days for test tube meat.
There's simply the issue of making enough of it at a price point where it's marketable, essentially.
Neil Stevens is a social scientist at Cardiff University. It cost $250,000 to create one 5-ounce burger. Stevens says large-scale, low-cost manufacturing could be a long way off, to say the least.
It simply may never be possible to produce the quantities that is envisaged. To do that on a large scale is a long way from where we are today.
And there's another major hurdle to clear. Judging by these customers lining up at a butcher's shop near London, test tube meat could encounter some consumer resistance.
No, I certainly would not eat it.
Probably not. It's just not natural.
There's too much with science that's manipulating food.
I think I'd like to see the cow. You know, I mean, the paddock eating the grass.
Moira Evans, Neil Owen, Tony Bales and Jennifer Wills. In Maastricht, Mark Post concedes he faces an uphill task, but he believes he's made a breakthrough, showing that test tube meat is at least a possibility. At the European Desk in London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Finding a place that does good delivery, Chinese, Mexican, whatever you fancy, is a lot easier than it used to be. You could Yelp it, sure, or you could hit one of those sites that let you enter your address, pull up the menus for places nearby, and then make your order. There is news today that two of the better-known food ordering services have decided to break some bread together. Grubhub and Seamless are going to merge, which means what exactly for you or your favorite restaurants? Here's Marketplace's Jeff Tyler.
Ordering food to go is big business. In 2011, Americans spent $69 billion on takeout, says Grubhub CEO Matt Maloney.
Almost all of it was placed over the phone from paper menus.
His counterpart, Seamless CEO Jonathan Zabuski, agrees.
Our competition is the paper menu because less than 5% of U.S. diners use services like ours to order takeout.
Together, Grubhub and Seamless expect to take a bigger bite out of that market. Peter Krasislavsky is an analyst with the research firm BIA Kelsey.
But as smartphones become part of the culture, and everybody has their credit card kept inside their phones, and they're able to even keep tabs on what kind of tips they want to give people automatically, this is going to become really big.
Restaurants pick up the tab. To participate, they pay upwards of 10% from each order. Maloney says some pay more.
If you have a pizza place, say they're willing to give 10% for the incremental business. And then you have a sub shop down the street, well, they're willing to give 11%. And so we create this local competitive marketplace.
Restaurants that pay more get listed higher in search results, though Maloney says the rankings are also set by customer reviews. And he tells restaurant owners that he doesn't want to eat their lunch, that is, profit-wise.
We don't make a dime unless you make a dollar.
Analysts say the combined company could prove attractive to Wall Street. Many observers say the larger combined company stands a better chance of going public in the future. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
Those who lament the modern office design of cubicles and compartmentalization may want to reconsider things, by which I mean you might not know how good you have it right now. A growing number of companies are packing people into ever smaller workspaces, ditching offices and cubicles in favor of a more open floor plan. It can, supporters say, create a more collaborative work environment. But there is a more important business imperative going on here. From Minnesota Public Radio, Annie Baxter reports.
Before they became a dystopian symbol of the American office, cubicles were meant to be nice. You know, a slick and sophisticated place where the average worker and her machines could have a little privacy.
She needs a special, easy-to-get-to place to work. She needs space for her machines along with room for herself.
It was all part of a concept that the furniture maker Herman Miller called the action office.
She's an action secretary, and she needs action office.
But collaboration is where the action is today. Cubicle walls are coming down so workers can communicate more easily.
We want the 60,
yes,
through the end of the year.
That's the case at the Minneapolis office of Cassidy Turley. It's a commercial real estate services firm. The company recently moved into a new space with a more open floor plan. In the old days, most of the staff had private offices. Now only three do. Everyone else sits or stands at desks with no cubicle walls separating them. Noam Newman is an associate broker there. He says he doesn't mind overhearing his colleagues' phone calls because he can take pointers on deal-making.
If I am hearing them, it's probably a positive because I'm hearing how they interact with clients.
The energetic chatter may not bother Newman, but the office can get pretty loud with people working elbow to elbow in some cases. Still, lots of companies are overhauling their office plans in a similar way. Over the last couple decades, the average worker has gone from having 90 square feet of space to just 75. That's according to the International Facility Management Association. One of the biggest factors driving the trend is this: less space means lower costs. Dennis Panzer is the managing principal of Cassidy Turley. He says his company chose to go with an open plan for a lot of reasons, but there was a big savings. In the company's old office, which occupied way more square footage, the rent was 50% higher.
if you can save a dollar in cost, there's no additional revenue that needs to get produced, and it can fall right to the bottom line.
There is a hidden cost in productivity and morale.
Susan Cain is a former Wall Street attorney turned author and speaker, and she's not a big fan of open office plans. She says they make it hard for workers to concentrate. She's not advocating sticking with the lonely old cubicle. Instead, Cain thinks companies should have a healthy mix of collaborative spaces, like cafes, and quiet places, like libraries.
Make sure that you are building in zones of privacy throughout, quiet places where people can go to really focus, really concentrate, really have a private conversation.
But that might be wishful thinking, given that some companies are doing extreme office makeovers and nixing employee workspaces altogether. Dennis Panzer at Cassidy Turley says some accounting firms assume their workers will embed at clients' offices and not need a desk back at the mothership. Panzer says it's all fair game when you're looking to cut costs.
The way we say it in our office, if you show me one company that's expanding, I can show you five that are downsizing.
If workers aren't thrilled about all the downsizing, there might be some comfort in knowing that at least it's just their cubicles getting whacked, and not them. In St. Paul, Minnesota, I'm Annie Baxter for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, which, and there is no other way to say it, is sheer unadulterated good news. World Nutella Day will live on. Sarah Rosso, an American living in Italy, started the observance of all things Nutella 6 years ago. February 5th was the designated day for hazelnut chocolatey goodness. And then last month, she got a cease and desist order from the Italian firm Ferrero, makers of said Nutella. I am pleased to be able to tell you today they have had a change of heart. Nutella Day indoors. You may worship in public, should you so choose. I observe in private, a spoonful or two every now and then when I've had a really long day. All right. That's Marketplace from APM. Today, the Dow up 52 points, about a third of 1%. The NASDAQ up 5 points, a tenth percent. The S&P 500 tacked on 2 points, also a tenth of 1%. Thanks to Sean Pattage, Justin Ho, and Katie Long on our Morning Report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by Rod Abeed. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Sometimes, actually, it's three people if it's a bad day. We'll see you tomorrow. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.